here's the reality. Basically, open source models are absolutely catching up. And it's true that OpenAI is a front runner. But for a lot of use cases, you don't need the best model. You just need something that's like 80% of the way there. I would say the area that is currently preventing me from going super deep into open source is because the context windows are still relatively small. And so I can't push the limits and really get it working smoothly for people who want to process, you know, hour-long audio files. But I know that that day will come, and it's not that far away.
Luke, welcome to the show, man. I am really excited to dig into this. I've only found the tool that you are responsible for here. And it's actually, I was curious if you built this by yourself or if you have like a small team that you're working with.
Sure. That's a great question. So the current composition is it's myself and a former developer from a previous startup that I found. And so I was tinkering on in the AI space kind of with a few small projects and little fun projects that I was working on. And he was one of my favorite employees to work with at my previous company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was a little bored and I had a little bit of free time, I suppose. And so I was like, hey, why don't we work on something? We currently have a 60-40 red share split. I'm 60, he's 40. He writes the code, and then I engage with, you know, customers and work on marketing and kind of think about like product and where the product needs to go. And so we basically have it where we both kind of get the thing that we're looking for, which is a fun little project to work on, and B, for paid customers, there's an incentive to just like make it worth our time. And so I have it split right now where basically like we have it up to a point where I just am like, I don't need the money. So I am kind of giving him the first 100% of a certain dollar amount just because I know that the startup investment and time from a developer perspective is a little bit more, the bar is a little bit higher. And then for marketing and other things, it's more of that slow, just continue to chip away, you know, hour by hour, week by week. So that's the current split. It's just myself and another developer. And I think I'd like to keep it that way. We intentionally built the product to keep it really, really small, really, really simple. And ideally pack a lot of value in a small package, so to speak.
Gotcha. Okay. So, and I was entirely exposed to this through the AI report. That the Spirit of Satoshi team did, and Marty Bent's opening like forward to that. And I didn't know anything about parse prompt ahead of time, but I had been doing a extremely rough version of something like it. I put transcripts into, like, I have a little tool that I've actually built with a video related to AI Unchained actually on YouTube. That's using Whisper, and I'm not a developer, but we've started, myself and the developer that I'm working with, Hope, we've started a little series called Devs Who Can't Code, and it's about what can I build with AI, even though I'm not a programmer. And he kind of like guides and reflects on like, well, it probably would work better this way, but the way ChatGPT or Mixtral told you to do it might, I think that's actually going to work because of blah, blah, blah. So like he basically gives the programmer perspective but I essentially take the reins and let AI do as much of the work as I can. And it's about learning how to talk to the AI so it can build stuff for me. And I've built a lot of these little, what I refer to as micro apps that basically simplify my workflow or combine a bunch of things. Like the transcription one that I was telling you about is built with FFmpeg and Whisper, all local or whatever. So I have a little drag and drop thing where every time I'm done with an episode, I literally drag whatever media it is. It'll take any type of media, then turn it into the right format and then transcribe it. And I have a subtitle file and a transcription file like immediately. Then I can take that transcription file and go to ChatGPT and, you know, get details and get it to write me a really kind of dumb description with three sentences. But there's usually one little nugget of like, oh, that's good. I like that framing. And then I'll use it. It simplifies coming up with ideas. And my favorite thing is I've now gotten to a habit of just saying like, I'll put that link in the show notes, which I actually already did anyway. But the funny thing is because that's next to every link or reference or anything, don't worry, I'll put it in the show notes. I can just ask the AI to find all my references that I said I'm going to put in the show notes, and it will literally pull them all out, and I'll have a list to do stuff. So there's like a lot of like really clever little uses for just having kind of a contextual readout of what you're doing. And you built Parse Prompt. So now that we've kind of established this, tell me what Parse Prompt is and how it works as well. Like, what's the foundation for this whole thing?
Yeah, sure. So I'll kind of start with maybe the problem that I was running into, and then I'll walk you through. Mm-hmm. I'll start with Parse Prompt is an easy way to repurpose content that is currently kind of locked up in certain, we'll call it file types, right? And so if you think about a YouTube video, maybe at its surface, it's like, you know, call it an MP4. But beneath it, there's like all this metadata, there's transcription data you can get from it. It's like, it's so much richer than a flat file, right? The same is kind of true also with PDFs, with audio files and other media assets, right? And so what ends up happening is you have this really rich body of content that is locked away in what I would just consider to be a flat object, right? And so Parse Prompt tries to make it easy to kind of unshackle your content from those assets so that you can repurpose it and reuse it. So I come from a marketing background, and I have quite a bit of experience over the years in SEO. And so, you know, you have webinar content and all this other content that you're constantly producing. And you kind of look at it and you say, well, if I'm putting in the work to go on a podcast or record a YouTube video, wouldn't it be nice if I could easily write a blog post about the same bedrock of content that exists in that recording that I did, right? But it's like, oh my gosh, I don't want to have to repeat myself. Like, I don't like repeating myself. And so if you can turn one media asset into multiple, you basically can leverage your marketing efforts way more than you could before. And so the problem, what caused me to kind of start looking into this space and building was primarily I was working with a nonprofit. And I was it's a volunteer thing, and they have about 1,600 audio files that are about an hour long. And they, over the years, had published all of this content. Speaking of open source, it's like, it's available for everybody. But they created a website where they would market these different assets, and they would get thousands of visitors a month with these very, with these pages with really thin content. Like, they might have a sentence or two where they would describe like the purpose of the audio, but that was about it. And I became, and here they are asking me like, hey, how do we get more traffic? How do we get more people interested in these audio assets? And I just was thinking about it. It's like, okay, well, first of all, anything that I do, it has to be semi-automated. Like, I can't go one by one copying and pasting. That feels ridiculous. It's fine for the ad hoc stuff. But I was like, okay, I need to build something that is more for scale, right? But I was just infatuated by the problem space, because it's like, well, if we could kind of unshackle these amazing pieces and unshackle, you know, these assets, well, then we could get a lot more distribution, and they can hit their, you know, goals as a nonprofit a lot faster. And so I started, you know, just kind of hacking things together. I was trying to use like no code tools And I was thinking about, you know, just basically writing code to try to solve the problem. And I kept running into issues. Mm-hmm. So specifically, you mentioned you're using Whisper. Well, Whisper's great and it's low cost, but I believe, if I recall correctly, there's a 30 megabyte limit in place. Where basically it will not transcribe.
Yeah, I have to downgrade it a lot. I do like 16 kilohertz or something, I think, as like, because my files are like 300 megabytes easy. I have to make it really crappy audio quality to get it to work.
Yes, exactly. And so I was like, well, that feels like a less than ideal solution. And you know, Whisper's great, but are there other tools that I could use, pay the money? Like, there's the willingness to pay by this nonprofit was there. Like, they're willing to put a few grand to work. And so how ParsePrompt works specifically is, it's honestly not rocket science, but how it works is you basically provide, you tell us what asset you have, right? What type of asset that you have. Mm-hmm. And you build a prompt. We call it a prompt template. So you say, okay, I have audio files and I want to do a thing over and over and over again, right? And so you basically build a prompt in our tool. You tell us what asset type is the input, and then you tell us what the output should be. So for example, the output could be just, you know, plain text, but it could also be like Markdown if you use you know, WordPress or Ghost or some other blogging platform. Text is fine, but you probably at some point will want something else. For developers, you know, you can do JSON, outputs, which are really helpful for, you know, structured content needs. And so you're basically saying, I have these inputs, I need this output, I here are my instructions, and then for each asset type or for each asset that you give me, I want you to run this job, basically. I want you to run this prompt over and over and over again for the number of assets that I give you. And so what it does is it really depends on the input. Right. So if it's a PDF, we basically extract the text out of the PDF. For YouTube and audio specifically, well, for YouTube, we technically can access the transcript from YouTube directly if there is one. And so, you know, you can extract that. It's free.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
For people who are looking for a higher quality bar, we basically recommend using a tool like Assembly AI. Which is it's basically a dev tool for processing audio files and then turning it into a transcript.
I came across Assembly, but I could not figure out how to utilize it. It's not something that you can run local, right? It's a service.
Yes.
Or am I wrong about that?
Yes, exactly. It is. Okay. Basically their world is developers. And I was like, okay. I know how to, you know, hit APIs, but it's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. That there isn't an easier solution. Like, why isn't there just like a WYSIWYG, basically? Like, what you see is what you get kind of editor for that tool. And why can't I just like feed that into AI prompts? So here's basically the pipeline, so to speak, and how ParsePrompt works. So you take the media asset. So let's say it's an audio file. It hits Assembly AI, returns a transcript, right? So it goes, okay, we'll give you the transcript. It then takes the transcript, which is the output after interacting with Assembly AI, and then it feeds it into your AI prompt. And so it's almost like you're talking to ChatGPT or a similar tool, but you're saying, here's my transcript. I want you to answer questions about it, or I want you to extract the key highlights from this provided body of content. So it's just simply, it's almost like daisy chaining things together, right? It's saying, I need the transcript to do anything. If it's just if it's a media file, like AI won't really do anything with that. But if I can turn it into text, I can then feed that in, extract insight from it using AI. And then the output can then be passed, you know, you can download it locally. You can also use no-code tooling like Zapier to basically push it into Google Docs. Push it into a CRM, push it anywhere you want. And so it's like a media processing pipeline, basically. And ideally, you do it at a certain level of scale. If you just do ad hoc things, if you're just, you know, tinkering around, You probably don't need this tool, but if you're doing anything on a repeatable basis and you want to save some time, you should probably take a look at this.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I've been trying to figure out like one of the things that I've always thought has been really powerful with the idea of these AI tools and LLMs in particular is the power of translation. And I don't mean that purely in the sense of from one language to another, but what's really interesting is that you actually could get a far more intuitive translation between languages that's more nuanced to the language rather than, you know, which word means which word, because they don't always line up. You know, a lot of times it's meaning. But the other thing was the translation between media types, translation between network types and formatting types. And it's become incredibly powerful in that already. Like one of the things I have done, and it's kind of an insanely slow and painful process, especially when I'm just kind of doing generic research, and especially when it's not something related to the show. Like I'm doing, I was trying to search stuff about COVID or vaccines or some alternative light therapy thing. And, you know, so I start digging through a bunch of studies and there's a lot of nonsense, and it's really hard to make out. Studies are almost universally full of jargon, you know, and whether or not it's even necessary for the study, it's almost like they specifically want it to be more confusing so that it can't be digested. And one of the things I found that's really powerful just in the last like month or two is, and I've built myself a little prompt about it that's very similar, very in line with what you might do with Parse Prompt. I've built myself a little prompt of, can you give me the methodology for this study, what their findings were, if they compared it to other studies, what those were, can you pull out specific quotes from this in order to back up the bullet points that you're giving me? And then like, you know, so I've put this together over like trying it over, you know, 50 of these or so, on just like four or five different topics. And it's been a great way to actually get through a bunch of AI research papers because they're landing every day now. But holy crap, the simplicity and the ease at which I can find the ones that aren't actually, they're studies of studies, you know, they're meta studies. And I realize, oh, this is kind of a generic claim. This isn't even what they're kind of touting it as. Just through the summary, I can kind of understand that they're making a claim that they can't really back up. It's just kind of a broad conclusion that they've made. And that's just been a really, really powerful tool to sort through massive amounts of information and that translation. And the reason Parse Prompt is so interesting to me, it was literally the exact same reason Marty was using it in the opening of the AI report, was being able to turn podcast episodes into blog posts within very, very minimal work. Essentially being able to go through and I could even give it a format to basically say, follow this structure, you know? And I hadn't really pulled the trigger on that yet, but I may break down and actually use Parse Prompt, even though I was trying to figure out my own version of it, you know, locally with Whisper and, you know, all that stuff. But Whisper makes enough mistakes that it's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. So I feel like I would have to do a lot more meticulous breakdown of where the errors were, or like there was a really funny one actually the other day. I took a screenshot of it in case I was ever going to share it. It wrote something as a description. I can't remember exactly what I was asking it, but it, instead of saying AI Unchained, the episode was called AI Unshamed. Through the entire document or thing that was written, I was like, oh god, is this where I've come to? But on that note, actually, so you're using your two main tools on the back end of this are Assembly AI and ChatGPT, is that right?
So yes to Assembly AI, and it integrates with OpenAI as well as Anthropic, which is, I'd call it maybe the second place runner at the moment. It's close. Both of those are closed source.
Okay.
But yeah, I got early access to Anthropic. And one of the key unlocks here for processing media, especially lengthy media, is you need what's called a large context window. And so, not to bore you with the details, but basically, the key is to provide it text and say, I want you to look at what I gave you instead of drawing on your knowledge of, we'll call it the internet, right? And like, what you're doing is you're scoping down the data it has to look at so that the quality of the output goes up. And so up until maybe like 2 months ago, Anthropic was the only one with a large context window. So when I say large, like 100K, like 100,000 tokens. Now OpenAI has like 128K model. Anthropic boasts that they have a 200K model, but it's kind of garbage, to be honest. Like it's just super like weak and like wildly censored for my opinion. Like it just, like it's just very watered down.
And those are the worst.
Yeah, they really are. And so, yeah, we currently integrate with two closed source models at the moment, but my goal is to leverage some of the new open source technology that's popped up, whether it's Llama, Mistral, or something else. I will say the current limitations, especially with a very small team, is I'll describe the challenge and where I think the market is going. I think it's there's some positive shifts in route, but basically, imagine I want to integrate this piece of software with, let's say, two closed source models and five open source models. Those are based in its current state. That's like five APIs that my developer needs to basically custom build each at a time. And the truth of the matter is that OpenAI has quite a lead. And so your users, if you're asking them to provide, API keys to use your product, most of them, like it's almost like not super worth your time to support smaller, more nascent models right now, because you got to build the integration. You have to build like, the necessary APIs. And sometimes those APIs are different, right? So you basically have to build like, it's almost like the juice isn't worth the squeeze, because it's like, well, I need to basically refactor my backend code base to support these models that not very many people are asking me about right now. And so it's kind of the risk to reward ratio is a little bit off. With that being said, and I started looking around in the market, but there are these tools that are popping up where what they do is they provide what I'll call almost like a layer of abstraction between you and the, we'll call base APIs that you need to tap into. So what they do is they give you a single API to use to integrate with, and then they handle the complexity with their libraries so that you don't need to build five different integrations. You just need to use their API and then flip a switch to use a different model. It bridges
to all the other ones.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so there's some upstarts there, and I'm excited about those. But there's a few small roadblocks.
Do you have a couple of those off the top of your head?
There's one. I was fiddling around with it. One raised a bunch of money recently. How about this? I will send you links later. They're like kind of generic names that totally like go in one ear and out the other.
They don't stick. Yeah. I got LM Studio.
Okay.
Which is one that I use a lot. Actually has, if I'm local hosting it, they boast, I haven't played around with this because I haven't utilized this at all in kind of my micro app building. But they boast that whatever you build for OpenAI API, you can actually just take that right out and put in LM Studio. And then you can use any of the open source models in LM Studio, and it will just talk to LM Studio, and LM Studio will do the rest of it for you. So that it's, you can basically swap it out. And I believe Prim, P-R-E-M, Prim AI does that too. I cannot remember specifically, but those are the two that I have been focused on for trying to self-host and run this sort of stuff myself. I just haven't really had the opportunity to go deep into any of it. But yeah, if you had links to that stuff, I would be infinitely thankful.
Yeah. Yeah. One company I know raised, gosh, at least $100 million recently for this promise. Yeah. And then there's another one, which I believe is completely open source, or just about completely open source. And I'm very interested in seeing this develop. I thought that this is what would happen months ago, because I do some AI stuff at my day job. And it's exciting to see the market develop, because here's the reality. Basically, open source models are absolutely catching up. And it's true that OpenAI is a front runner. But for a lot of use cases, you don't need the best model. You just need something that's like 80% of the way there. I would say the area for that is currently preventing me from going super deep into open source is because the context windows are still relatively small. And so I can't push the limits and really get it working smoothly for people who want to process, you know, hour long audio files. But I know that that day will come, and it's not that far away. So I am very bullish on open source, because I'm not a big fan of OpenAI. They are, I think, very two-faced in how they project to the public and how they operate. I don't trust them. I do not trust, like, I would not trust them over the long term. But we also, I think, need to acknowledge the reality, which is that they are an early front runner for a reason, and it's because their product is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. So on that, actually, so you say open source is catching up here. In what way, and do you have a particular model, and do you see it, like, do you see still major leaps happening, you know, in the near future with the larger proprietary models? Like, what is it about open source that's kind of allowing it to catch up, and how quickly is that happening, at least in your frame?
Yeah, so I think this may sound like cheesy and maybe weak, but I actually think, so you kind of have this race, right, that's happening between Google and basically Microsoft, right? OpenAI is basically Microsoft's child at the end of the day, or at least it's heavily controlled by Microsoft. And so they are incentivized to create closed source models. I know for a fact, for example, Google has a model that like I have access to that I'm testing that's new, and apparently it's supposed to compete with, you know, GPT-4. And so like they are very much going at each other, right? And but it's from a closed angle. And then you have, you know, and say what you want about Facebook, but they are basically going full open source. And
which is so awesome.
Yeah.
I cannot, I did not expect that either. Jan LeCun, like some of the stuff that I've listened to him say and his perspective on it, I would love to get that guy on the show and pick his brain, because holy crap, it's basically the thesis, the whole reason why I felt like I wanted to do this show. And I have got to hand it to them. The company that made Facebook, which is basically the CIA spyware, like nightmare that I would never want to touch in a million years, is probably the biggest reason I'm seriously bullish about open source AI. So just a little insertion there.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And like, you know, maybe they stab us in the back later, right? But
always a possibility.
But they are incentivized. Like, I feel like the minute you go open source, it's very difficult to unwind that, right? And and so I think they are incentivized to basically just throw a wrench at the horse race that's going on right now. And I'm totally here for it. You know, it's like, go for it, you know? And they have the resources to be able to throw a lot of wrenches. And so I, you know, I can't complain. Then you also have, you know, I don't know, this is another example where it's like, it's unclear to me how I mean, it's an open source model, but they have kind of, we'll call it closed source hosting, but it's a Mistral, right? Like they're VC backed. Mm-hmm. They are a developer fan favorite, or like they have a huge amount of momentum from the developer community, which says a lot. And so, yeah, they, at the end of the day, they have to make money. But once again, if you're open source, like they could probably charge based on hosting and, you know, just like more secure instances and all these things that enterprises want. And they can make hay over there, but they can keep the model free. And so I think I'm very bullish about, the growing open source community here. And I think, as is typical with any open source movement, there's always derivatives that pop up, and they, you know, if it's not Mistral, it might be something else that is derived or forked from their code base. And so that makes me very bullish over the long term. There is catching up that I believe needs to be done, but I would say even from like an enterprise perspective, like, you know, if you're OpenAI, like all your money is made selling, you know, call it six-figure a year deals. And this is kind of the funny part, is open source is a much more compelling argument for the enterprise, because they don't want to send their data to OpenAI. And OpenAI can say, we don't keep your data all day long, but they still have stringent requirements.
You have no idea. Yeah.
Right. And so that makes me feel like there's basically various pressures that these closed source providers are facing. So you have the upstart, which is, we'll call it open source. Then you have, the nature of the market is very competitive from a cost perspective. So you constantly need to release new and arguably more expensive models over the long term, or else your revenue will just start, you know, being sucked dry. This is why I believe that OpenAI is going after this kind of like marketplace ecosystem. They're trying to get more into what I'll call like consumer facing stuff. Which I do not believe is their core competency. And they're getting squeezed by the enterprise around these large contracts because of data security reasons. I will say, this leads me to maybe the conclusion, and I believe that this is the most telling sign, is when your founder is running around talking with politicians all day long, that is a clear sign that something is top of mind. You don't do that for fun. I don't think anybody does that for fun.
Yeah.
You do it for a reason, right? and so
you want a moat.
Yeah, that's a moat, right? Like there's a regulatory moat. And so they're going to basically LARP all day long about how safe they are. But meanwhile, like, you know, having interacted with people at this organization, they are constantly shipping. They are not, they can talk all day long about how they keep things real. Like, we always test all day long. We test and we don't put anything out in front of people, unless it's been thoroughly tested. And it's like, that is complete nonsense. Like, I've seen them go from idea to shipped product in 2 weeks.
This show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. My favorite setup, which I know I talk about a lot, is the Nunchuck wallet on mobile. That just connects directly to or just talks NFC whenever I need to sign. The Nunchuck does not hold my keys. It is securely on my cold card, not connected to the internet, not vulnerable to a phishing email or any malware or anything like that. If I ever need to send a transaction, I just create the transaction on my Nunchuck wallet and I tap it to my cold card. I hit sign, I tap it again, and then off it goes. There is no easier interface and way of interacting that grants a higher level of security, in my opinion, than that right there. It's genuinely incredible to me that we even have this capability in the Bitcoin space. And CoinKite has just made an entire suite of fascinating security and just fun Bitcoin devices and hardware products, like the block clock. Just connect it to your node and have it show the Bitcoin price, have it show the block height, just right there on your desk in this really cool package. If you haven't checked out what they have to offer, you definitely need to. And don't, when you go over there, do not forget that I have a 9% discount code. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, gets you 9% off. And you can go through the link in the show notes or just remember the discount code, which is not hard. It's just the name of the show. You can go through the link in the show notes to go right there or just go to the store, browse around, see what you want, get yourself a solid hardware wallet, experience the tap to send with a Cold Card hardware wallet. It's just kind of magical. And get notified for the Q1. I'm really stoked about my Cypherpunk BlackBerry, the new model that's going to be coming out. So check that out as well. Don't forget, 9% off. The link is right in the show notes. Go check them out.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm curious about that. You specifically, I believe the word you said was two-faced. What do you, so you see OpenAI public version, so to speak, and you have also, I mean, as closely as this even entails, worked with OpenAI, so to speak. But what did you mean by that comment, and what have you seen that makes you think that?
So the fundamental concern that I have is that there is a public perception. So, like, what is the number one fear that people have about AI? And it's like the fear is that it becomes unchecked and basically, you know, triggers a nuclear bomb, right? Or some permutation of that, yeah. Right? And mm-hmm. So there's this huge emphasis on safety, especially to regulators, and that's fine, but we have to consider the DNA of this company is like heavily rooted in, basically Bay Area startup, Y Combinator. And the philosophy there is ship really fast, find product market fit, rinse and repeat over and over again. And so there is a huge emphasis put on shipping. And so my concern mm-hmm. is, I feel like those are competing ideas at the end of the day. And so there is this well-manicured outer perception around safety, but the internals around how a product is actually built is very fast moving. And I don't fault them for that, but I just think it's inconsistent. Mm-hmm. And I think they kind of have to pick a lane at the end of the day. And like, these are very smart people, like props to them for building a pretty solid product. I certainly disagree with their, censorship. But like they are very good at building product. And it's like, why? Is it because they, pony up to regulators all day? I don't think so. It's because they're good at shipping code.
You know, I'm curious on back on the open source front, is one of the only models, and this is honestly, I've had better experience with this than Llama 2. Granted, some of the fine tuned Llama 2 models that I've played around with, I haven't really dug deep. And I haven't really dug deep in the Mistral model either, but Mistral's newest, or I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, I could not be the newest anymore with the way these things seem to go. The Mistral 7B times 8, which is their mixture of experts thing, where they have 7 billion parameter models that are quote unquote specialized in different tasks, or I guess 7 that are specialized in different tasks. And then one that essentially manages which one should be in charge of the task when you ask it a prompt. I've had shockingly good results from that one on my own computer. My one limitation is both, like you said before, context window and speed. Is it even, I have a M1 Pro or Max, whatever it is, the most obnoxious of the first iteration of the M1. And it is sluggish. I often, if I'm asking it for something big, I often go to something else and come back. So I'm curious what your thoughts on that. And have you used that model in particular by chance?
Yeah. So that was one of the models that I had a chance to play around with. That gets me excited. And I would say, in terms of, speed and latency, I think that is a solvable problem. So for example, mm-hmm. I don't know if you hosted the model, basically on your own metal, or if you used a cloud hosted model, but it's like, I have to believe that that will become less of an issue over time. And like, candidly, OpenAI at times like really has issues. I mean, Anthropic's pretty slow. Yeah. And so the, so I think that that's a solvable problem. And I don't necessarily, like, that doesn't concern me that much. I think the good news is that you can just see.
I think that will come with time really quickly, actually.
Yeah, exactly. But like with the quality of the output, it's like, okay, this feels like I would compare it to GPT 3.5 Turbo, right? It's like, it's analogous.
Yeah, that's a fair comparison. Yeah, it really is.
Right? And and for some people, like, that's all they need. Like, if you're just doing some basically, you know, tagging operations or something, it's like, maybe that's all you need. But if you needed to, like, you know, write a blog post, I mean, GPT-4 is still the best that I have found. Anthropic being, you know, runner-up.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked into or seen anything about Yarn? I read a paper, and this is a couple of months ago now, but it was about them being able to turn other models, basically give a larger context window in a far, far more efficient manner. And they boasted 132K for their context windows for like basic open source, like 7 billion parameter models that are, you know, freely available. And I downloaded one of them, and I think I may have just misunderstood how to use LM Studio to do that, but I couldn't quite get it to do what it claimed. And, you know, my context window was clearly still tiny, and I couldn't figure out what I almost want to say it was LM Studio that was actually limiting me, because it was the exact same limit it had been before. But I was wondering if you had, since you say that specifically as a limitation, have you explored that at all? And do you know specifically of Yarn, since that's the only thing I had seen on that side of trying to solve that problem?
Yeah. So I feel like I've heard of that before. And it may, I'm trying to remember if it was the same thing. I saw something recently, maybe a couple weeks ago, where these, and I didn't read the paper, but I kind of got the TLDR, which was that these people are, you know, they understand that, you know, context windows are kind of the keys to the kingdom for a lot of use cases. And so what they were working on is almost like a different approach to how do you, it's almost like they had a way to pick from a larger mass of data, a smaller context window, right? So it was kind of this idea of like, look and identify the relevant snippet or chunk, and then... Okay. And then use that to feed in to achieve a similar result. So you could feed it, you know, like an enormous amount of content. And because it had the ability to chunk, it could kind of work its way through and still give you a high quality output.
So it's possibly more of a hack than an actual different way to do context. You know, it's kind of like a layered hack.
Yeah, I would call it maybe in the short term like a bit of a hacked solution, but I do believe it was primarily, it was a research paper. And so I think, you know, there's people that are very interested in solving this problem. I think they're going to solve it. I don't think it's going to take that long.
Yeah. 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 And especially with, it's crazy how many people, like how much is moving on the, like getting chips, and then like the next era of chips, anything that lands in 2024, I swear to God, there's going to be an AI specific like benefit to all the new CPUs, all the new GPUs. You know, it seems very clear that we may even in the short to midterm get a sort of ASIC for, you know, transformers to work. Almost like a like GPU for graphics, is we get almost an AI ASIC that we plug into. It might be a PCI slot card, you know, who knows. But I'm curious if you like what you have seen on the hardware front for, have you been seeing the same thing? What's your trajectory, do you think, for the future on that? And how do you think it will relate to how you can run parse prompt or changes that you want to make to that?
Yeah, sure. So I'll say the first big disclaimer is this is an area where I have not spent a huge amount of time. I'll speak kind of maybe at a high level for like what would, no pun intended, prompt me to dig more in into the space. I would say, so the current reality is like, you know, the hardware is in short supply. NVIDIA stock is way up. There will be other entrants. NVIDIA is clearly an early, it's the early and way far ahead leader. And so you kind of have this, you know, gold rush for chips. And I think, and maybe this is how it feathers into the future of what I'm building. What I think a lot more about when it comes to the hardware is if regulation comes or when it does, will they basically, you know, there's kind of all these AI philosophers that are like, you need to shut down, like regulate all the, you know, the like basically just like clamp down on the chips and clamp down on mm-hmm. the hardware, because that's kind of, you know, the foundation for the training and everything else. And so they have a pretty big emphasis on the hardware. And so if regulation happens, is that a country by country thing? Could that be a state by state thing? Like, what are the legalities? I get very interested in this idea of, you know, you could easily see in, you know, let's say a future election, there being this, like, arguably unnecessary fear around AI's role in the election, right? It's like the perfect scapegoat.
Yeah.
And so, so you can kind of see like a world where they clamp down or attempt to, and where states push back. And that really gets my wheels turning around. Is there a world where, you know, think about Bitcoin mining, for instance, right? Where there are states that are very feminine to Bitcoin miners. Why couldn't the same also be true for AI hardware, right? And hosting. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's, you know, they're basically very similar dynamics at play. They are politically charged. They both, I mean, the AI chips consume a huge amount of energy. Like, talk about boiling mm-hmm. the ocean. and so you can kind of see a setup where there's like a clampdown or a potential clampdown, and you have these kind of, you know, like wildcat operations where they're running hosting centers off-grid, similarly to that of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Like it, that doesn't seem yeah. far-fetched. And so that's the thing that I really...
And with the amount of capital and like value that you could get out of it, I see the whole offshore potential. I mean, it's huge. It's very much like Bitcoin mining. As long as you can get to where you have a place to set up, you can reach customers anywhere in the world. So it doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and also like if these are, you know, power intensive, which they are, like, where the hosting center is going to go, they're going to go to states with low cost power. Tell you one thing, as someone who used to live in, broadly speaking, the Northeast, you do not find low cost power in the Northeast, right? Like the red states are really, really, much more, inexpensive, for energy consumption. And so like, there's just this really interesting potential dynamic that could spin up. I think my hope is that, you know, freedom reigns. But you can easily see AI being the scapegoat.
Yeah, of a lot.
Yes.
It's just the nobody understands it. Everybody's afraid of it. That's why everything broke. You know, it's AI and Bitcoin are going to be the scapegoat for everything in the next few years, I feel like. I'm curious. So you're a Bitcoiner. We didn't really talk about it much up to now. But I believe you said you didn't take... I didn't really dig into it, but you didn't take Bitcoin on Parse Prompt, and you hinted at a reason why. What was that? What's the difficulty there? Because part of my thesis or something that I've talked about on the show is how I feel like AI and Bitcoin are actually almost made for each other in a way, with the idea that your cost is irreversible in AI and your cost is in computation largely. Like, you know, it's immediate feedback. And then the same thing on the opposite side, you have like Lightning and Bitcoin, it's instant it's instant gone on the other side, so that chargebacks are likely to be a big problem as things move forward, or especially as things scale. So what's the other side of that argument? Why does it not fit for you in particular, or your conditions or environment?
Yeah. So I would say, I try to stay on top of this as much as I can, but I will freely admit that there's probably someone working on this that I should, I need to go check out their website. Right. And so what I would say is, right, the cost to implement, the dev cost to implement Stripe, for example, it's a well-known library, relatively easy to use. It's hosted. I'm shooting fish in a barrel, basically. Like, if you have a credit card and you want to pay me money, you can do that with Stripe. And so I know that I'm going to get 100% coverage.
Easy reach.
Right? Yeah. 100% coverage.
Yeah.
And so if you have limited dev resources, you're going to start there. Right? And, I think what I would love to have is a fallback option. Actually, I'll take a step back. Whether someone uses a credit card or not, like if someone pays me in fiat, I am going to literally use as much profit as possible to go out. Like, this software company is a Bitcoin mining company. It just happens to use fiat to get it. Whether someone pays me in cash or not, like, I'm still going to go out and buy Bitcoin. Like, this is a project that I'm working on for fun, for learning, keeping, my product instincts fresh, and also to get as much Bitcoin with the proceeds as possible. And so that's the mission, right? So I'm going to do that whether someone pays me Bitcoin or not. Now, what would be great is if there was an easy to use API that, where I could predictively charge on a regular basis. If someone wanted to use, if they wanted to pay in Bitcoin, they could pay in Bitcoin, but it would need to be on a subscription basis. Like, this is not a, as much as I love the promise of streaming money, I actually think that if I've learned anything working in software, it's like every time you charge somebody for every transaction you charge,
it's friction.
It's friction, right? And they think about it.
Yeah.
And they think about it over and over and over and over again because you're charging them over and over and over again. And so I love the promise of that, but I also like it creates this cost question and it just keeps it at the top of their mind. And whereas a subscription is like, hey, it's, $50 a month. We'll ding your card, once a month and that's it. So it's a predictable concept that people can, select in or out of. So what I would really love to see is, this is not an e-commerce model. So it's not about the ad hoc payments. If it was, I could easily, find something and integrate Bitcoin there. Like, there's plenty of stuff out there. But I don't want the streaming money use case is, I'm bullish on the idea. I'm less bullish on the implementation. And so what I would love is just an easy way to be able to create a subscription-based offering where, I can basically suck money out of their wallet, but do it in a way that's, not in a hacky way, right?
Yeah. No, 100%. That's like one of the big things. This is why I'm not sure what degree of knowledge you have about this, about Bolt 12, which is a implementation tech that is proposed for Lightning to essentially do subscriptions over Lightning network communication, so that you could have recurring communications with that other person and their node or their client, whatever it is. And I believe Bolt 12 or something around it also has you can pre-sign to have transactions pullable, at some point. Right now, the one that I believe is closest to just working that way for me that I don't have to think a lot about and is pretty low friction is Lunanode. They're hosting stuff because they accept Lightning, but I buy credits. So, and one of the things that would be interesting is like have like a minimal limit on like how many credits you can pre-buy or something. Like they let me do like just like $5. And I think I do like $30 a month or whatever for my thing. So it wouldn't really do a whole lot of good, but I usually do like $100 at a time or something just to refill. So it's like once a quarter I have to think about it. And it just tells me when my balance is low. I mean, obviously like I'm using it and that's not a subscription model really. That's just me prepaying for the service. But 100% I can see how implementation details and like the difficulty of that. And then also the, from a business side, from a user side, I want 100% control. I hate that I sign up for something and I can forget about it for 3 months and it keeps charging me. And then I find it and I'd be like, shit, I lost $40 a month for 3 months for something I'm not even using. And then I have to go rush to figure out which email I used and how to cancel and all of that stuff. So from the user side, I still want full control and I want full visibility. But then from the business side, I also don't want the hassle of having to berate the customer to be like, please pay again this month, you know, and then run into potentially them not even just not getting the email. And then it shuts down for a week and they're sending me support tickets. Like, why is my stuff not working? And, you know, just like that, the degree of hassle I can see, because as much as the pull system has its drawbacks, it has a very, very simple benefit to setting up that sort of relationship that is low friction and low in people's faces. You know, it doesn't require a lot of maintenance. It's kind of like what I do with Swan. Like the reason I love the service or whatever and the auto purchasing and auto withdrawing is because I literally don't have to deal with it. You know, I don't have to think about it. So it just buys and then sends it to me. So like lowering that friction, 100%, that needs to happen. That's why I want it to happen at the Lightning Network protocol level, because that would be awesome to think it was sovereign in that way. But it could likely just end up being dominated by an API, a service, a Stripe sort of thing, Strike maybe even, you know, for simplifying that sort of a setup. In fact, Strike should do that. That would be they have a really big network. That would be right in line with, you know, that use case, or their space.
At the end of the day, how I think about it is, I would love to push the limits on the tech. Where I see my contribution to, let's say, the Bitcoin community in particular with this project is maybe like, well, first of all, building a solid product and trending towards open source models as fast as I can, I think is a good starting point. Mm-hmm. The second is stacking. Pushing the number up. And then the third is also, I think, you know, as someone who, you know, has written code in the past, but doesn't actively write code now, I think I am much more interested personally in this idea of how can you, build like an indie business or a side project or a future, you know, decent sized business and have a really interesting kind of Bitcoin treasury strategy. I know that's still early innings, so like treasury is kind of an overloaded word, but the idea is I'm much more interested in exploring how could you build a massively profitable business, even if it's not big, and keep expenses low, keep developing costs and marketing costs low, and then stack. Like, I think that's an area where I feel like, I find it personally exciting. I think that there's not a lot of, I haven't found a ton of resources about it. You know, it's like, oh, cool, MicroStrategy, and like a buddy of mine does it with his technology company, and it's great. But I think that there's a really interesting world that is unfolding in front of us where more organizations should do that. But it can reorient the way that the business thinks about profitability, especially if you work in kind of early stage tech, or if you work on a indie project where it's like, how can I build a simple product that delivers a massive amount of value without a ton of support costs, so that I can stack as much as possible?
Swan Bitcoin has the full suite of Bitcoin financial services. You can instantly buy, with your bank account or wire transfer, any amount of Bitcoin up to $10 million worth. And you can easily set up what I have been doing for ages, which is an automatic purchase of Bitcoin on a weekly or monthly basis. You just pick your time frame and then automatically withdraw it to your cold storage. And still they have free withdrawals to self-custody, which I was sure would be gone by now. But you should always treat any custodian as a point of failure. And luckily, you won't have to go anywhere for all of the information and advice you need for why you should withdraw and how to do it safely, because Swan Bitcoin has all of the resources you need and will regularly remind you. About 80% or more of their customers automatically withdraw their coins. That is an amazing feat, if you ask me. Then they also have the Swan IRA if you have a traditional IRA and you want to get it allocated to Bitcoin. And there's so much more. With Swan Private, they have inheritance planning. You also have Swan business accounts, and you can even do Bitcoin as a part of your employee benefit plans. They have an advisory. They have the Swan Vault, a multi-sig service for those who want to have the benefits of holding the majority of their keys, but still also want to be able to rely on a trusted institution in the case of an emergency or a disaster. If you haven't started into Bitcoin yet, Swan is an amazing place to begin. Go to swan.com/guy. The link will be right there in the description. Again, that is swan.com/guy. And they will know that I sent you, and my beautiful face will be right there at the top of the page to greet you. I am a longtime user myself, and a huge thank you to Swan for supporting this show, and I definitely recommend you check them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and you said, you specifically said that you've been in VC environments and worked with like VC startups and stuff in the past as well, but that you're taking a very different strategy with ParsePrompt. It's very much like strip it down to exactly what it needs to be so that it's profitable. What's the dichotomy there? Like, you know, do these things align? Does the whole VC environment even align with kind of a Bitcoin world? Or does the culture just seem to kind of clash from your perspective?
That's a good question. So, I've spent most of my career working in early stage venture-backed startups. I ran one for years, and that started off as a side project. And so I actively made the decision to take a company that was profitable at the time. It was consuming a decent amount of time, but I said, yeah, I want to take a big swing here and see what happens. And, you know, I would say I thoroughly enjoyed the experience. It was a very different experience, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. I learned a lot, and I don't necessarily have a bone to pick with VC-backed startups and venture capital in general, but you kind of need to know what you're signing up for, right? And I would say the model, which is not rocket science to probably most of your listeners, but it's this concept of like no profit. Everything is invested in the growth. You're burning anywhere from $100K a month to a few $100K a month, depending on what stage you're in. Mm. So for example, my seed stage startup was burning 90 to 110K a month. And at the time, I would say I was conservative. And if you were a Series A, you're probably burning 200K a month. And, you know, the model is grow big super quickly, exploit some market opportunity, and ideally find a buyer or go public, but most likely find a buyer. And and so, you know, founders are conditioned to do that. Their boards are pushing them and encouraging them in that direction. They also signed up for this. So it's not like it's a surprise. Like, you know what you sign up for.
Yeah.
And so I do think that the model could break in a world where Bitcoin is seen as, where the general perception is seen as Bitcoin, you know, basically it's the ultimate treasury asset. It's compounding, it's growing. You know, it is the digital gold equivalent. And so part of my rationale for believing that is because the VC model started in the 60s. And so some of the early, some of the early funds, were, established from like, oil, money. And so what also happened in the 60s? It's like, well, we went off, maybe it was the early 70s, but we went off the gold standard. And money became much...
We deviated in the 60s. It was the 70s when we admitted that that deviation was irreparable. You know, like, so they essentially issued a ton of unbacked debt, and the U.S. gold balances started to get just drained year after year after year. And it was 71 that it was basically, it was done. So it is very ironic that the entire VC culture and kind of way of doing business existed in the era of fiat, issue lots and lots of debt that you can't actually pay for, and you know, through to today. So that's a great point.
Yeah, you know, so I think that these are very much competing ideas, and I think there's going to be some swath of you know, founders or people that just want to tinker on side projects. And they will start to see that they could, instead of, you know, doing the VC game, they could potentially keep costs low and basically build a real business. Right? And when I say real, I mean, basically build a traditional business, right? Where profitability is king.
That it makes more than it uses.
Yes. And I see AI and Bitcoin converging here because AI... dramatically has the potential, depending on the use case, to dramatically reduce the cost of development. It explodes the value that can be created by, you know, one or a two person team. I fully buy that. And so if that is true, well, then you will see more profitable startups going after niches. And what are they going to do with the excess cash is the question, I think. Maybe they pocket it all. Cool, but like, I think that some non-trivial number of people will probably end up buying Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Especially as we get into a new era where Bitcoin, like I think with this next bull market that we seem pretty clearly to be running into right now, it's going to completely change the general perception around what this thing is, especially now that it's, you know, creeping its way, its tentacles are getting into legacy finance, and I'm sure they think they're going to control it. And I think the opposite is going to happen.
So I'll share a little bit more nuance that I think your listeners would be really interested to hear. When I signed my term sheet, call it 4 years ago, for my venture-backed startup, there was a clause in that said I could not buy cryptos. That was put in, to my understanding, and it may vary depending on the firm, but I would say it's probably standard practice, at least for most, you know, venture capitalists. But there's a clause that said you can't buy crypto. A friend who runs a startup that was funded, also VC-backed, he last raised, call it 2017, 2018 territory. There was no clause. Mm-hmm. And so he was currently profitable and stacking, and he uses his treasury to stack Bitcoin. And so I don't expect that that newly funded VC-backed startups will be able to stack Bitcoin directly, but I think potentially some of them will finagle something with the Bitcoin ETF and portfolio construction to basically back into that, right? I think you could see some people
to roundabout get exposure to it.
Yes. Yeah. But I also think that this creates a compelling reason for a Bitcoiner founder to potentially explore more profitable options, is because if you ever think you want your part of your treasury to be in Bitcoin, you will probably face a term sheet where you either have to negotiate that out or they won't do the deal.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting point. I'm curious, I want to go back to a technical thing that I have specifically run into. Have you ever used what the tool that MVK and whoever he's working with built called unleashed.chat?
Oh, I haven't. I haven't even heard of this.
Okay. You should check it out. They do, like you can just set up an account with just your email, but just like getting a login link. And then you can just pay sats for however many tokens you want to just answer questions or whatever as needed. And one of the things that they pull, in fact, this might actually be very relevant to Parse Prompt because they host it. They're using open source models for all of this. And I specifically, I haven't dug into it with him. I mean, in fact, I might even should just get him on the show to just ask about how they're doing a lot of what they're doing. But I've been trying to figure out the nuance in using large amounts of data, a large PDF, large text file, and using that in the context window of a model or ChatGPT, and then vectorizing it and using it that way. And I do not quite understand the real details. Maybe I'm conceptually missing how these things fit together. Like the question I asked MVK actually when I was looking at this tool, I shot him a message. I said, what model are you guys using to vectorize? Because I know Prim has a bunch of vector models where I can feed it a bunch of information. It will vectorize it. And then suddenly I can use this in some other model. And he said, we're not actually using a model. We just wrote a whole bunch of code to make it work with large things. I was like, wait a second. So you don't need, I'm missing something here. And I was wondering, do you know about this? Is this something that you're looking into? Or right now you're just kind of leveraging ChatGPT to have them sort that out on their side. And it's not front of mind for you.
So I'm going to do my best to explain this as a non-technical person.
Okay.
And, you know, I work in tech and we heavily leverage this stuff. So I do have a little bit more than the average knowledge than the average person off the street. But to the listener, do your own diligence here for what I'm about ready to say. So I view it as there's maybe like three paths that you can take. The first is you can leverage the context window. And I would say the benefit of that is that it's kind of obvious how you can use it. Right? It's like feed in data and say, I want you to stare at this and tell me more about it or process it or translate it or whatever the instruction is. It's very simple. So the pro is that it's simple. The con is that it is limited by the size of the context window. So that's, I'd call it avenue one. And I definitely believe that is for how we use it. That's our approach. Then there's another approach, which is you can basically create, and I'm totally spacing out on exactly. Let me just pull up the API while I, yeah. So there's fine tuning, right? And so you can say, okay, I have this data basically a fine tuning in a nutshell from a non-technical perspective is you give it an example prompt and you give it the desired output. OpenAI has fine-tuning models, and you can basically upload a list of items where you're basically saying, hey, here's the desired output, and I would like for you to stare at this when you create new outputs in the future. The idea is you are giving it sample data at the end of the day. Okay? I would say the upside of this approach is if you have enough data, you can really fine tune things. The downside is that you need a lot of sample data. And also, it is not super, super easy, at least historically, to create these fine tunings. So I have experimented quite a bit with trying to see if fine tunings can do what I need it to. And for the use case that we support, I have not found a lot of success. I would much prefer to use and leverage the context windows at hand. Then there's the third, which is, I would say, not necessarily even, I'll just include this for the listener. But then there's this idea of, I want to store data, let's say about my business, in a database. So it could be in a vector database like Pinecone. It could be in Postgres, and then you use a tool called pgvector to vectorize the data. The long story short with vectorizing data is that imagine an X and a Y axis. And it is, you basically provide, you have an ask, let's say. So imagine a question like, what is Bob's favorite color. And it will look over the database of content and it will try to find, once again, non-technical answer, like a nearest neighbor. So it's like, where's the closest result that I can find? And it's almost like it's plotting it on an XY axis. So it's like, of these available options, it's, you know, putting a stamp somewhere. And that stamp, whatever's adjacent to it, it's going to try to return that. And so this is incredibly useful for what I'll call Q&A, right? Where you have a question, you ask a question about a large set of data, and it returns a very neat and clean response. That is really wonderful for Q&A. A fine-tuning model is more for, I would say it's very much not used for Q&A. That is used more for, I would say, kind of baking in AI into a workflow or a process. And then there's the hacky, I think, more effective approach for certain use cases, which is just leveraging the context window.
Just make a big freaking context window.
Yeah, and I'll put it this way.
Okay.
Fine-tuning, I would argue, is really good at, like, if you can't provide anything, but you still needed to generate a half-decent answer or analyze the data, like, that's probably the best use case for that. If you have a question and answer, set it up with a vector database, ask it a question, find the nearest neighbor. And then for a parse prompt like use case, you're basically saying, I have the data. I need you to just like extract information, parse it, translate it basically. It's more of a translation engine at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if I wanted to, thinking in the context of where I would use vector, the idea of a vector database is I would, like, let's say I'm trying to like get some sort of context or relationship to my notes, and I have thousands and thousands of notes that I've taken over some period of time, is that I would either use a model or some sort of tool. What was one of the ones you said?
Something
vector. Maybe that was the one. But regardless, I'd use some sort of tool that's specifically for that. And rather than having to utilize some sort of a context window with all of that data, I guess it would like chunk this thing up and then put each one of these things in a quote unquote location, and it would be content relevant. So, you know, if I was asking about like royalty, it would be near all of the things that said king or queen. If I'm understanding that correctly, it would basically, rather than some exact specific search, it would find context relevant search, mostly because the model is compressing that information anyway.
Yeah.
That's, you know, what LLMs do.
Yes. I think about it as like, imagine like search on a website. So let's say you want to implement, you have years of podcast episodes. Let's say they're all in transcripts, and you want to make it really easy for a visitor to find the relevant podcast episode where you talk about whatever, insert topic here. You would want to use a vector database to do that. And as you describe, basically it returns a chunk, and then it basically shovels it into something like OpenAI or Anthropic and translates that chunk into a really easy to read output, right? So that's why these vector databases and using LLMs on the front end is really a potent combo, is because it's not only returning like that nearest neighbor, so to speak, but it's also presenting and packaging the content using the best of why people love LLMs. It's like it's like talking to you in certain ways that are just like way easier to understand than like a wall of text.
Yeah. Yeah. So essentially the way I want to utilize that with my own setup is I definitely need to be thinking about and looking more specifically in the tools to vectorize enormous amounts of data. Because that exact example that you just gave is something I want to do. One thing I'm trying to figure out right now is just build a simple little thing to modify my transcription at my drag and drop to basically download my entire, well, I've already got a little thing that will download and did download every episode of my show. But we'll download literally every single episode, transcribe them as best as it can, then vectorize the thing. So I have an AI that I can talk to, Mixtral, whatever it is on my machine down here. And from wherever I am, I can basically ask it and it can give me either the relevant chunk, like summarize, you know, some chunk of information from one of my shows, or just pull the episode. Because there's so many times where I cannot believe how many times somebody says, you talk about something in a guy's take somewhere. And do you remember what episode that was? It's like, I have no idea. Like, I had some great analogy about like Bitcoin's energy use. And it was literally in an episode about personal responsibility or something. Like, it has nothing to do with, you know, energy or anything. Or it's just like some toy. My scatterbrained rantness is all over the place. So oceans of great little tidbits, I'm sure, are lost in the 1,100 or so episodes that I've done on this freaking show. But that is definitely something that I've been trying to explore, and that answers the question that's what I'm looking for, that I do explicitly need to create a vector database, and that's how I need to think about it. So much appreciated. With that, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I know I could just kind of keep going generically about like AI and a lot of stuff that's going on, but maybe I'll just turn this over to you. What is there anything else you specifically want to cover, or that what are you most interested in right now? What are you watching that might be related to Parse Prompt or might be related to some other side project that you would be working on if Parse Prompt wasn't taking your side project time? Either
That's
or.
A good question. I would say AI, something in AI is the most obvious example, because there's so much energy and it's still early. If I wasn't working on this, I'd probably be doing something different. Candidly, the examples that you gave around, you know, just easily spinning up a vector database and having, you know, website search or something similar is like a pretty great business opportunity. So I think that could be a really cool opportunity, for people. I think, you know, I would strongly recommend if you end up building this, you should definitely use Postgres and pgvector, because you could spend an arm and a leg on something like Pinecone or similar. I would say the things that get me really excited, maybe to go back to a comment you made earlier. You mentioned that, you know, and I think this is actually a really, really good summary of the value of AI, which is like, if you think about it as a really smart translator, I would say you basically just described 80% of the use cases for AI in its current state, right? It has the ability to take
a
body of content and turn it into something different that maybe resonates with people in a way that is different than the source content. If that is true, I think it changes a lot of things. So the first thing I'll mention is I have actually experimented quite a bit around the translation piece. And so, for example, I have updated a non-trivial number of old books written in old English to modern English, because it's fun, and why not?
Oh, that's cool. And that's something that it would be particularly good at, because it's not a huge modification, but it is something that makes it feel like you're reading through molasses. You know, you know, like it's real sluggish when you're trying to digest that. It's like, wait, what the hell is he trying to say? But if you give it a couple seconds, you get it, you know?
Yeah. And so I am like, you know, this is maybe an aside, but I actually think that in itself is really exciting, because it's easy for us to think in today's society that maybe A, everything is new, and B, we are also really smart in the current moment. And I would argue both of those are probably not true. And the reason why I would argue that both of those are probably not
100%,
true 100% is because I would actually argue that I am unconvinced that we actually know history that well. And I believe personally, one of the blockers for us better understanding history is that there is a language barrier, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I were to go read, heck, even the Constitution, it may be a little bit difficult for me to parse, or the Bill of Rights, mm-hmm. or some other old document. But if that information can become a bit more unlocked, yes, it's a little bit watered down, let's say, or it's a derivative. You know, it's not always a perfect clone. But I think the more people are exposed to that original source content, even if it's updated a little bit, there's an opportunity. There's almost like this big red pill that happens, right? Where you are just like, mm-hmm. wait just a second. Like, these people yeah. were way smarter than I thought they were. So for example,
everything old is new again.
Exactly. So for example, it's hard to pull exact data, but the highest literacy rate in America was in the, I believe, the late 1700s, where the literacy wow. rate was like in the 90s, like in the 90%
wow.
territory. And it's like, well, what did they use to teach their children? And like, what did they use? What did they do? And so if you can go back and look at that source content and digest it quickly, it all of a sudden, your wheels just start turning. And so that's something that I find very, very interesting, is kind of unlocking the past. That's one that I find very interesting, more for, you know, personal reasons than, amazing business opportunity. I mean, I feel like the things that I've been tinkering on are, like, naturally, they're going to be the most interesting things for me. I would just advocate for anybody listening. There's totally a gold rush. Like, only way I can describe what's going on right now is, it's like, there are literally $100 bills lying all over the floor. And for people who spend even a small amount of time, you could just pick up a few of those. And it could be a really wonderful business. These opportunities don't come every day. And I certainly haven't seen anything like this in, you know, my career working in tech, which is, you know, 15-ish years.
Yeah, I'm curious. Why don't you take the opportunity right now to make your pitch for Parse Prompt? I mean, we've already kind of described it. But just because you have the audience and you have a tool, like, pitch me Parse Prompt. I might personally use it, but pitch me anyway.
Yeah, sure. So if you want to repurpose content, media, files, YouTube videos, audio, PDFs, and you do not want to, if you need to process those assets at scale, you should totally use this tool. And basically it's, you know, $25, $50, $100 a month, depending on depending on the package. But depending on the use case, it can basically be an entire content marketing team. Like, there's been multiple people that have said, I would have spent thousands of dollars and I just paid $100 for what you're doing.
And, to accomplish this, yeah.
Yeah, and so I would say, if you're looking to repurpose content that is currently locked away, you should definitely try the tool. And we don't charge you based on, you have to pay OpenAI per API call, but we don't like charge a spread on how often you use the tool. So you could like go crazy. And we just charge like a flat fee and that's it. It can even process your Zoom meetings. So it can take those Zoom meetings.
I've been doing
summarize them.
I've been doing a real hacky version of that, but no, that's exactly like, it's actually a hugely, hugely like valuable thing, because I was actually planning on hiring someone, or at least thinking about like kind of an executive assistant sort of person to help manage, you know, who I need to follow up with and, you know, where the conversation was taking place. And one of the big things was I wanted them to get into my meetings. And so that they could write me bullet points list, you know, basically do the equivalent of meeting notes, right? I'm slowly, it's a little bit of a headache the way I'm doing it, but it works. It works right now. But it would be so cool to have one that has higher fidelity. Mine has still missed a thing here or there, and it's not perfect. But it's incredible how incredibly valuable that is. just to have half of a solution, you know, like it really makes a massive difference. And these sorts of implementations are where, like as you say, there's just $100, you know, laying on the ground, and you can just pick them up with a rather simple implementation because of how many different easy integrations that you can do to combine these things to just complete some sort of a task in a totally automated fashion. And it's exciting to hear that you are also in the thinking that open source is catching up, because that's what I've been hoping. That's what I thought I've been seeing, but I like it when other people seem from a different place seem to see the same thing, because I want to be able to self-host all of this stuff. I've been using things like Parse Prompt more recently, just because, God, it saves so much time to have somebody else build the workflow for me. but I want to be able to do it on my own machine for a bunch of different reasons, but also just because I'm a DIY kind of guy, you know, like I just love those sorts of tools and playing around with them. So it's exciting. It's exciting. And it's crazy. I'm super happy that Marty wrote the foreword for that piece, because I might not have bumped into Parse Prompt. I was immediately like, oh shit, this is literally like one of the tools I'm trying to build for myself right now. Like, I'm actually trying to build this, and you have already built it. So, thank you. Thank you for that. And, thank you for coming on the show, dude. This is a really good conversation. We might have to do it again sometime, especially with how you plan to expand or building other things. If this, you know, like really works out, I'm excited.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. I can certainly come back and give a state of the union, like, you know, at some point in time in the future, based on like some of the stuff I'm seeing as, you know, someone who's actively in the marketplace. But yeah, I think we should expect more change. We should expect more advancements. I will leave you and your listeners with one last thing, where I actually think this is overhyped.
Oh yeah, that's a great, great conclusion.
Yeah. Yes. So where AI is overhyped, from my opinion, is around this agents concept. And I'll briefly describe it. Basically, it's this idea of, what if you could have AI perform all these activities for you, and basically like perform an activity and then build on that with another activity and build on that with another activity. I would like to propose that is not a really, they're kind of competing concepts, if I'm honest, because what you're doing is you're asking an agent to perform one of N different tasks, let's say, and then you know, for this to be really useful, it needs to perform, like it needs to kind of chain those actions together on top of each other. Mm-hmm. And imagine, you know, AIs hallucinate, right? They sometimes get off track. And so, you know, I'm not an engineer, but I'll briefly describe. So there's this whole idea of like deterministic versus non-deterministic. For the layman, it's this idea of pick and choose, or pick one option, right? And AI, if it indeed hallucinates even a little bit, why would you want to stitch together hallucination? And so what you end up wanting, the desire is for predictability, but what the AI gives you is sometimes predictability, but sometimes not.
Necessarily might not be. Yeah.
Right. And so
that's interesting.
Right.
That's a really interesting take.
So think about it this way. I think in some ways, the regulators are kind of right just a little bit. And here's how I think they're kind of right, in that if AI goes unhinged, right, if it is given one of a bunch of different options and you program it to behave a certain way, like it could hit the nuclear button, right? Like, and it's like, oops, I hallucinated. And it's like, well, there is a very serious real world outcome that you accidentally hit the red button. And even for like, I want you to send an email and then I want you to book a dinner and a reservation and all this stuff. It's like, what happens when it calls, some totally terrible restaurant, books a reservation there, and then, yeah, like you can see how it can kind of quickly become a little wild. So people desire predictability. What the AI gives is sometimes predictability. And of course, the accuracy will get better. But at the end of the day, some of the magic of AI, at least in its current state, is this, you don't know what you're getting. You know, write a blog post and you're like, oh my gosh, this is totally not what I expected, but it's great. So anyway.
No, that's awesome. That's a really great point. And if I wanted to steel man and keep going with that, is that as soon as you're, like you said, if you're chaining these things together, you kind of get this mistake butterfly effect, where one mistake made at one location can be exacerbated at each additional step because the agent isn't going to recognize the mistake. And when you're dealing with models that are 90% effective, that's great when you're getting it to do one task, because you can basically be the filter to seeing whether or not if it's on the right path or making corrections along the way. Whereas if the agent is doing this in a series of things, which is also going to up your cost because you're using a bunch of different things, well, then your end result might be completely unhinged, because at every step you have a 10% failure rate. You know, that's a really great point. And it also lends itself to the implementation details will probably not be agents controlling agents. The really good ones will be ones that are just strict software based, where you know exactly what your prompt is, you know exactly what your environment is, and you've restricted the output in some way so that you have a higher expectation of exactly what you're going to get. So software, rather than agents, controlling LLMs, you're likely to see an era where very strict software built a very strict way can basically use a handful of different models or a series of models or whatever in the completion of that task. And you know what you're going to get, and its quality may vary a little bit just in how you choose to, the underlying models you choose to get there. That's a really great point. Well, awesome. Awesome, dude. Thank you. Thank you so much for this. Thanks for coming on the show. And I hope we stay in touch. If you ever need anything or you want to explore something, and I'll probably bug you with questions if you're okay with it. But keep a DM open on Twitter or Telegram, wherever you want to chat. I'd love to.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I assume I'll probably see you at the Bitcoin conference this year.
Yeah. Dude, we should definitely get together. I'll get you a drink.
Awesome.
We'll hang out.
Cool. Great.